Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Roger Hearing, and on this edition, will the $6 billion trade in the illegal drug Captagon that funded the Assad dictatorship be disrupted now that he's gone? Also, US inflation creeps up, but a California restaurateur tells us he's seeing more optimism among consumers.
I'm cautiously optimistic. I can only go by, you know, who's coming into the restaurant, what they're spending. And both we have increased customers and check averages up slightly. So both of those things are indicators that people are feeling a little bit more secure.
Plus, the Macy's employee who hid $150 million in delivery charges, and why universities in Australia are worried by plans to drastically cut the number of overseas students.
I have no idea whether I'm going to get work next semester. For us here at Sydney University, we're expecting a pretty drastic decrease in the number of commencing students.
And you can contact us about all this that you're hearing on WhatsApp, or you can send us a voice note, 0044 330 678 3033. That's 0044 330 678 3033. Now, Syria is still adjusting to the end of a decades-long dictatorship. But along with opening up prisons and burning the tomb of Assad's father, Syrians have been discovering the factories and stores of the illegal drug Captagon. Social media video coming out of the country appears to show factories where what's often called the poor man's cocaine may have been made. In this video, people are kicking white pills scattered across a warehouse floor, and you can see laboratory equipment said to be in the headquarters of a military division commanded by the former president's brother. Captagon was developed in the 1960s and marketed as a treatment for depression, brain injury and narcolepsy, but as it fell from medical use in the 1980s, the name came to be applied to an illicit mix of amphetamine and caffeine. It's been claimed by the US, Britain and other countries that the Assad government funded itself by manufacturing and distributing Captagon in an industry that's produced millions of addicts across the Middle East and is said to be worth $6 billion a year. Here's Britain's Foreign Secretary David Lammy speaking to Parliament on Monday and explaining why the UK had refused to re-engage with the Assad regime.
We said no because Assad is a butcher with the blood of countless innocents on his hands. And we said no because Assad was a drug dealer funding his regime through Captagon and illicit finance.
Well, a former Syrian army officer told BBC News Arabic Investigations last year he believed the Assad government methodically built up the Captagon industry. This soldier had previously worked closely with the 4th Division, which protected the government from domestic and international threats, and was led by the former president's brother, Maher.
عندما لاحظ النظام السوري أهمية
Once the Syrian regime noticed the amount of money obtained from this industry, only a few selected individuals were allowed to run the Captagon factories. Since then, three large factories were established. Now there's talk of a fourth. All the money is collected and sent to the palace to Bashar al-Assad. Bashar al-Assad is the only one who's requesting this money. Bashar al-Assad's financial structure is now based on this trade. It's him who's allowing it. When we say narco state, we mean the whole economy is based on this industry. It's enough to run the state's economy.
Well, the former Syrian government didn't respond to the BBC's request for comment on this, but it had previously denied any involvement in the drugs trade. I've been speaking to Vanda Felbab-Brown, director of the Initiative on Non-State Armed Actors at the Brookings Institution in Washington. So first, what exactly is Captagon?
Captagon is a drug that's increasing in use in the Middle East, particularly in the Gulf. It's a mixture of caffeine and amphetamine. So it's a fairly weak drug, but nonetheless, of course, it's addictive. It's referred to the term Captagon, which is a pharmaceutical drug that was developed several decades ago, and that's chemically very different than what is called Captagon.
And it's widely available in the Middle East at the moment. I mean, there are a lot of addicts out there, is that right?
So Captagon is widely available in the Middle East. It is produced or was produced during the Assad regime on a massive scale, on an industrial scale by the Assad regime and used to finance the regime. Upper estimates put the yearly annual revenues at about $6 billion. That's a very high number. I'm not sure that I believe that number, but it's certainly plausible that the Assad regime was making hundreds of millions, perhaps low billions of dollars from the drug. and variety of actors in Syria, in Iraq, Lebanon, Turkey, there are still smuggling Captagon, particularly to the Gulf.
And therefore, I guess, involved in crime in that area as well, criminals producing it and also criminals trading it.
There is certainly a criminal element in the way that we think about criminal groups. But what was characteristic of production in Syria was that you had state-level involvement, including, of course, relatives of Bashar Assad, such as his cousins that were sanctioned by the United States, his younger brother Maher al-Assad, who was the commander of an elite military unit. His 4th Armored Division was one of the principal smugglers of Captagon across the Middle East. But you had a variety of other actors involved, Hezbollah, pro-Iranian, Iraqi militia groups such as Kataib Hezbollah, Turkish criminal organizations, the Syrian National Army, a collection of militias sponsored by Turkey, have elements involved in the trafficking. Many of the SNA militias are, in fact, criminal organizations. And there are also accusations that HDS had participated in Captagon trafficking.
So given that allegation, does that suggest that the trade in Captagon may in fact continue?
Well, apparently their statements have come out from HDS that they will suppress Captagon trafficking. I think part of the messaging to the world that Jalani has been putting out is that he wants to be governing, yes, through a jihadist Islamist prism, but in ways that are not provocative or widely provocative of the region. So he's been sending all kinds of reassuring messages about not using chemical weapons that might be inherited from the Assad regime. And it seems they've also been messaging they will suppress Captagon production. And there have been recent images on various social platforms sharing videos from labs belonging to the Assad regime. And presumably the Captagon will be disposed of. But the odds are very high that both production and trafficking will continue. The question is what part of Syria it will be located and how will the market be redivided.
Vanda Felbab-Brown there, the Brookings Institution. Now, for some time, there have been moves in the US and other Western countries to get equipment made by the Chinese telecommunications firms, Huawei and ZTE, out of their systems over concerns about national security. But it's an expensive undertaking. The House of Representatives and the US Congress has just voted to back a motion to use part of its huge defense budget, about $3 billion, to help American companies remove this equipment. Tim Donovan's the CEO of Competitive Carriers Association, which represents the telecoms industry in the US, and he's just tested to Congress on all this. I asked him why the money was needed.
The carriers that CCA represents that have this equipment have been mandated by the federal government to remove it because of national security concerns. But so far, the Congress has only provided a little under 40% of the funds to do that. These carriers simply cannot complete that mandate without the remaining funding that's necessary.
But some people might say, well, you know, it's buyer beware on all this because it was pretty clear that China, what Chinese companies were doing. And when your members put this stuff in, they knew the risks.
A lot of these members operate in some of the most remote parts of the country at extraordinarily thin margins. And part of how they do their build out is often through different support programs. Some of those have inadvertently actually supported including some of this equipment. For example, there was a program at the Federal Communications Commission that distributed support through a reverse auction. So to win the money, you had to have the lowest bid. How did you get the lowest bid? You used the lowest cost equipment that you were able to have available. And at the time, this equipment was not prohibited. So that structure actually forced carriers to select this equipment and put it into service in the first place.
Okay, it's getting rid of Huawei stuff and ZTE stuff. How will that be done? You pull it out and you put other American perhaps made stuff in instead?
Yes, the rip and replace name is a little bit of a misnomer. You really need to replace and then rip so that you can maintain connectivity. But it is to replace that equipment with those from trusted vendors, both American companies as well as those that the government has approved as trusted partners.
And if you couldn't get this money, if you couldn't get the $3 billion, would American broadband telecom users start to notice big problems coming through? I mean, would it be effectively a problem for the users?
Absolutely. And the way that where these carriers operate, it would affect not only their customers, but any Americans that travel through their footprint. To give you an example, one group of five of our members that are going through this program that collectively serve fewer than 200,000 of their own subscribers, connected over 60 million Americans last year who traveled through their networks because there was no other network available. So this would create huge holes in coverage in major parts of the country, including for services like 911 and emergency services.
But it'd be fair to say that your member's going to be a bit wary in future of cheaper Chinese technology in this sort of area.
Yeah, we're really looking for better information sharing with the government so that we can make sure that we're making decisions that put security first.
Tim Donovan there. Well, Eva Doe is tech reporter with The Washington Post. She's got a new book out, in fact, coming out soon, House of Huawei, Inside the Secret World of China's Most Powerful Company. Joins us now. Eva, thanks for being with us. It's likely this is going to go through the Senate, I guess. Senate has still got to write it off. But will it then be enough to actually get rid of Huawei and ZTE tech out of the U.S. communication system?
Yes, well, this is going to be a big step towards that. And I think it's very difficult to make a communications system absolutely hack-proof. And we've seen that recently in news of major hacks by China-sponsored groups.
This is the thing called Typhoon Salt or something, I think. Is that right?
Yes, the Salt Typhoon hack. And that kind of proves even the biggest U.S. telecom systems that already have removed Huawei, that they still are not fully hack-proof. But for these smaller ones, they are much more vulnerable for many reasons, including that they're using sort of the cheapest off-the-shelf equipment that they could get. So this is going to be a major step for them to be able to remove that equipment and replace it.
Yeah, and it's certainly going to cost a lot, $3 billion by the sound of it. But in a way, I mean, it seems odd it's coming out of defense budget, but I suppose it is an issue of defense if it's the only way to make sure that China, and many people see it as a potentially bad actor in this, can't control the system.
Yes, certainly. And so Congress in general, the FCC has been calling on Congress to fill this $3 billion gap for several years. And it's been difficult to come up with this money. But this defense bill, the annual defense budget, it's seen as a must-pass piece of legislation. And so including it as part of this makes it smooth the path to having this done.
We'll see if it goes through. Eva, thanks so much for being with us. Eva Doe there of The Washington Post. Now, there's been a slight increase in U.S. inflation for the second month running. The annual rate rose by a tenth of a percentage point in November to stand at 2.7%. The figure was in line with market forecasts. It's part of what the outgoing president, Joe Biden, claimed for his economic legacy this week at the Brookings Institution in Washington.
Inflation came down to pre-pandemic levels. Wages have increased, but still too many working and middle-class families struggle with high prices for housing and groceries and the daily needs of life. At the same time as inflation and interest rates continue to fall, we've entered a new phase of our economic resurgence. With the outcome of this election, we also face an inflection point. And do we continue to grow the economy from the middle out and the bottom up, investing in all of America and Americans, supporting unions and working families, as we have the past 4 years, do we move backward, in my view, backslide, to an economy that benefited those at the top while working people in the middle class struggled?
President Biden. But as always, it's how it feels for ordinary Americans that actually matters. Earlier, I spoke to Dwayne Greenleaf. He's the owner of the Benchmark Restaurant in California. I asked him how inflation was affecting him and his business.
For me, it really comes down to consumer confidence. I think the number is what it is, and I think what that does is affect consumers' confidence. And if they don't feel good about what they have in their banks, they're not going to be shopping. They're not going to be coming to a restaurant.
Have you noticed, in terms of the people coming to you, fewer people coming, spending less? What's going on?
I think we felt this extremely just before the election. It seemed like people were very nervous about what was going on. And, you know, usually we have a very robust September, October, and November, and it was quite off, about 15% of what we normally see. And I think, again, it goes back to people were just very unsettled about what was going to happen with the election. And again, that I don't think that has anything to do with the actual inflation rate. It's just their confidence in what's going on with the economy.
And how have you noticed in the month, I suppose, since the election, are people beginning to make a decision, perhaps? Are they more confident?
Absolutely. This is probably the best, you know, here we are, what, 10 days, 11 days into December, and we've had a very, very steady stream of new clients at the restaurant, and it's feeling much different than it has the last 3 months. So again, that it's partially because of the holiday season. People are out celebrating. You know, companies are doing, you know, little holiday parties. And so we are seeing an uptick, even an increase from last year.
Yeah, because of course you're into a period before Christmas, and a lot of people are, I suppose, exactly as you say, celebrating office parties. But you're a real feeling that this is a change, though. This is moving in the right direction as far as you're concerned.
I do feel that way. I'm cautiously optimistic. You know, again, we look at, I can only go by, you know, who's coming into the restaurant, what they're spending, and both we have increased customers and check averages up slightly. So both of those things are indicators that people are feeling a little bit more secure.
And what about you, Duane, and your family? I mean, do you feel more secure yourself in terms of going out, buying stuff, having meals, perhaps doing whatever you do?
Yeah, I would say I was super cautious because mine's directly related to my restaurant. So, yeah, I was very nervous, and I didn't understand what was going on. I would walk around the other restaurants in our areas, and we were all slow. And so as bad as that made me feel, it also gave me a feeling of relief that it's just not me, you know. So, yeah, it's been – I am feeling better, and I am, you know, I am going out. And I, you know, I am spending money. And so, again, mine is a direct reflect of what my company is doing.
Duane Greenleaf there, owner of the Benchmark Restaurant in California. With me is Susan Schmidt, portfolio manager at Exchange Capital Resources in Chicago. Susan, thanks for being with us. It isn't an unexpected rise in inflation, but is it going to affect materially what the Federal Reserve does in terms of interest rates in the near future?
Not in the near future. Investors are still largely expecting the Fed to lower interest rates again when they meet next week. And so expectations are for a quarter percentage point drop. That would make it a full 1% down from when they started lowering rates earlier this fall. However, investors have backed off on expectations for rate cuts in 2025. They think that the Fed will likely pause after this because while inflation is moving in the right direction, that 2.7% that you've been talking about, it's still higher than the Fed's 2% targeted rate. Inflation and higher cost items are still an issue, and the Fed needs to stay on top of it.
So the program of cuts that have been predicted probably isn't going to happen, is what you're saying?
Likely not. Investors are getting less anxious about interest rates, more focused on what's happening in employment. And given that they're seeing these 2.7% numbers on inflation, again, still much higher than 2%, that's backing them off quite significantly.
Well, we'll see what happens. Of course, it's next week, I think, isn't it? We'll find out exactly where it's going. Susan, thanks for being with us. Stay with us, in fact, because we're going to talk to you a little bit later in the program about what's been happening on the markets. You're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Now, it may be the most famous US department store, and you'd think Macy's was looking forward to Christmas.
Thoughtful last-minute gifts? Got them. Five parties to dress for? Done.
That's a lot of parties.
I know. This holiday season, let Macy's be your guide to gifting.
But in fact, Macy's has been having a rather rough time. It had to delay its full quarterly earnings in November after discovering a rather embarrassing accounting issue. In the full results of its investigation just released, it said an employee had intentionally hidden around $151 million worth of delivery expenses on its accounting books for nearly 3 years. Well, the CEO of Macy's, Tony Spring, who stepped into the role back in February, said integrity is paramount at Macy's, and he said they'd identified and begun to implement additional controls to be a stronger and more disciplined organisation. Well, Daphne Howland's a senior reporter with Retail Dive, a national daily business publication covering the retail industry from Washington, joins us now. Daphne, I mean, this is a bit embarrassing. What do we think was actually going on?
It's pretty embarrassing. They didn't give a lot of details today, but they said this wasn't theft. This was an error that was made nearly 3 years ago. All the subsequent fraudulent entries were made to cover up that initial mistake.
But it seems extraordinary that a company could miss that sort of amount. I mean, it's a big company, sure, but $151 million.
I think there are a lot of question marks over that. They didn't really go into how they discovered it, why they didn't discover it. They did say that in that same time frame, they had $4.4 billion in delivery expenses. So maybe they tried to give the impression that $151 million maybe doesn't sound so bad. But I think this was a distraction at a time that Macy's wants to maybe be, you know, pointing to some slightly better results as it's been working to turn things around.
Yeah, and I mean, well, they've tried, obviously, in all this. Not least, they've actually got their results out now. So what do they tell us about the company's performance overall?
I mean, so generally, things did pretty well. Macy's is doing this thing. They're closing a bunch of stores. So they're sending out these reports these days, separating out stores that are going to be closed from the stores that are getting improvements. We are seeing smaller declines. We're seeing some chunks of stores actually have sales increases. But this delivery expense debacle didn't affect overall sales. It didn't really punch a big hole in the financials overall. But it did potentially hit margins. And that, I think, investors want to hear more about what happened there, because that goes to profitability.
Yeah, and that really is what matters, as you say, to shareholders. Thanks for taking us inside that, Daphne. That's Daphne Howland there with Retail Dive. Let's go back to Susan Schmidt. First of all, Susan, I mean, Macy's, as we said, finally got its third quarter earnings out. But, I mean, how was Wall Street responding to all this?
Well, Wall Street didn't love it. So we saw Macy's stock trade off a little bit today. That's not really anything to do at all with $150 million, because that was announced 3 weeks ago. Macy's just had to provide more detail around it. What investors focused on today, well, what were the sales numbers and the profitability of the stores? Macy's is having a hard time getting themselves back on track, attracting customers into the stores and getting that profitability up. And sales weren't where investors wanted them to be. So again, focusing on sales right this time of holiday season, consumers are out shopping. Where are they shopping? That's what investors care about right now. And apparently not at Macy's all that much.
No, I guess more online perhaps, and therefore profiting the digital economy, the new economy. And the Nasdaq, of course, which reflects that, had a bit of a record today, didn't it?
It did. So that's a great segue, Roger, right into Amazon, which did very well today in the stock market. And where customers are shopping, we are seeing the digital economy, and investors certainly reward tech featured and tech focused companies right now. NASDAQ hitting that new high. We've seen a lot of, I think, confidence from investors continuing on that AI trend, and that the economy will right itself over time as we move forward.
Well, we'll see how it plays out. Susan, thanks so much. Very interesting day there on Wall Street. Susan Schmidt. Now, there's a plan to limit the number of international students attending universities in Australia, and it could lead to the closure of as many as 300 colleges. Universities say it could also put thousands of jobs at risk. The Australian government says it's going to cap the number of students from abroad to 270,000 in order to create a better and fairer system, as Phil Mercer reports.
Graduation is a milestone to savour. But at the University of Sydney, not everyone's celebrating. Casual academic staff fear that planned caps on international students could cost them their jobs.
I have no idea whether I'm going to get work next semester. I'm Sophie Cotton. I'm a casual academic here at Sydney University in the Department of Political Economy. We apply for contracts every semester, and the number of contracts that get given out are dependent on the number of students that we are taking. I'm pretty horrified by the government's management of the university sector over this period. For us here at Sydney University, we're expecting a pretty drastic decrease in the number of commencing students.
But ministers say record levels of immigration, including students, have put more pressure on Australia's housing rental market. There are concerns too that visa loopholes allow some migrants into the country not to study but to work and stay indefinitely. Jason Clare is the Federal Education Minister.
It's important to send a message to the world that we want students to come here to study, but we want a managed system, not a free-for-all system, and we want to make sure that all institutions can benefit.
After iron ore, gas and coal, international education has been one of Australia's most valuable exports. It generated about $25 billion last year. The largest number of students have come from China and India. But the question is, will restricting enrolments from overseas damage Australia's reputation? Australia has one of the world's biggest international student markets, but that could change.
Options for the students are quite a few. Now new destinations have also come up in Europe and Asia and other places. But most of the students who are not coming to Australia would be looking at US and UK as the two alternatives. Ravi Lochan Singh, and I'm the managing director of a company called Global Reach, which has been recruiting for Australian education institutions for the last 33 years. International education is, I think, the third or the fourth biggest export item, is the number one service export. Australia is not a manufacturing country. So if you remove the mining sector, then education is the number one export for Australia. And if we limit this, we could actually make Australia very unwelcoming for international students in future.
Earlier this year, Australia was hosting more than 700,000 international students, a record number. For many like Abby Shi from Shanghai, a political economy and law graduate, it can be a life-changing experience.
I'm culturally a Chinese person for sure. When I go back to China, I notice a lot of the Australian traits coming from me. So, yeah, I'm definitely becoming more Australian. I love about that, yeah. And I like all Australian people. They're super friendly and super laid back.
Well, it's nice she's had a good experience. That was Phil Mercer there reporting on the issue of the universities in Australia and the attempt to ban many thousands of foreign students from going there. And that's an issue, of course, that's reflected in many places around the world, not least here in Britain as well. But that's it from World Business Report, from me and from the rest of the team. Bye-bye. Thanks for listening.